What you're about to experience is one man's quest to see beyond the tumultuous period we're in and to envision what lies just beyond our grasp, yet well within our reach. Welcome to Larry Rifkin's America Trends, where the future has arrived, and it's just in time.
Welcome back to America Trends, Larry Rifkin and John Kropczyk. And this is a very serious topic, John. You work your entire life, you commit yourself to a place, an industry, and you think you're really protected. I mean, you think because you have a pension, and that is gold. I mean, there are a lot of young people listening to us who probably don't even know, and I said that in the course of the conversation with our guest, what a pension is.
Yeah, I think in the private sector, I don't think pensions exist anymore. Everything is, you do it yourself now. It's do-it-yourself retirement, and it's very confusing.
That's a great way to put it, do-it-yourself retirement, and good luck trying to figure it out, particularly when we see these 401ks, and they are like the little engine that could pulling the entire retirement system when they were really meant at the beginning to be a supplement to another form of retirement, which was a guaranteed benefit. Now, it's oftentimes a guaranteed contribution. And oftentimes the guaranteed contribution is only on the part of the employee and not the employer any longer.
Right. It's a real mess system we have here. Throw into that Social Security and you know, your head starts spinning.
Well, we did another podcast, Downhill from Here. Check that one out with Catherine Newman about retirement. But people really used to love pensions. I mean, they would say, that gives me predictability, surety. It gives me really comfort knowing that I've worked all these years, 30 or 40, and that when that all ends, and many of these have been in really difficult industries, people really giving up their bodies, their minds, their hearts, their souls. And now they're finding that, unfortunately, many of those industries aren't able, really, to deliver on the promises that were made.
Yeah, that happened to my in-laws. My father-in-law worked for an industry for like 50 years or something. He was in there, and he had a guaranteed amount of money, and he had great medical benefits. And then they decided to fold, and it really was bad.
What happened? I mean, what kind of negotiation? Or
well, they gave him some kind of payout, and then they gave him money toward medical insurance. They threw him into the whole medical system where you got to figure out what plan you have and how much it's going to cost you, and they supplemented a little bit. But it's really was tough for them.
And he didn't expect any of this.
No. Well, it's a big company he worked for, so he thought
they were in good hands, good shape.
Absolutely.
And that they were putting enough money aside, that they weren't inflating certain of the
And he was guaranteed
returns.
X amount of dollars for you know, his retirement.
Yeah,
you know,
absolutely. So. Well, we know that in America, a lot of people are not really good at deferring monies for that long road ahead. America's saving rates are among the lowest in major economies. So the pension was the gold standard, guaranteed, locked down.
Well, I think also with inflation and stuff, I think it's hard for a lot of people now to save. You know, it's really, you know, you look at prices, we're paying a lot more for stuff than we were.
And, of course, a lot more things are considered essentials today than were in the past. Well, what we're going to look at today is a real crisis as it relates to these pensions. Something occurred on the last leg of the road to the American dream for workers who really should not be thinking about these issues at this time of life. They should be enjoying themselves. So, many of these pension plans have gone dry, belly up, or they are on the verge of insolvency. And workers who are living to enjoy the fruits of their labor many more years find themselves fearful that that benefit is not going to be there. And we have got the perfect guest to talk with us about this. His name is Joshua Gottbaum, And he explains what's happened here behind the headlines, breaking it all down for us. Now, John, he is with the Brookings Institution and their retirement security project. But he was also, for I think about 4 to 5 years, the director of what is called the Pension Benefit Guarantee Corporation, which the government established to backstop these pensions in case of distress and underfunding. So we thought not only did we have the guarantee that we work for a company that was solvent, or we work for an industry that had these multi-employer plans because they all ganged up to make certain that these pensions were going to be insured. But we also have a backstop, and it's called the PBGC. You'll often hear it called that. But they're in financial trouble as well, believe it or not.
Yeah, I believe it.
So what window do you go to for your payout? That's the problem. Well, let's talk about it. He's going to explain it all to us today, and he goes into great detail, almost giving us a primer on pensions. And it's really important that we all understand this. Even if you never imagine that you're going to be getting a pension, maybe your father or grandmother or what have you, they have been living on the benefits of a pension structure that used to be in America. And of course, we still do have it in many cases in the public sector.
Yes, they still have pensions.
Exactly. Well, let's go to Joshua, and he will give us all the details today. Really, really interesting material on America Trends.
On the line with us is Josh Gottbaum, and he's with the Brookings Institution, formerly the director of the Pension Benefit Guarantee Corporation from 2010 to 2014, and that will become very relevant to this conversation as we move along. We're talking, of course, about pensions and the difficult situation that many of them are in. And Josh, for those young people who listen to our podcast, they may not know what a pension is because there aren't too many of them being given out these days. Could you get into something as basic as that to start?
Sure. But let me start with one important preconception that you said just isn't plain true. Right now in America today, there are something on the order of 70 million people who have some kind of pension benefit, meaning they have a retirement benefit that their employer guarantees will be a certain amount of money when they retire. The most common form of retirement savings, as you have noted, is a retirement savings account. You can call them 401ks or IRAs or whatever, or individual savings account, et cetera. And that's a case in which the employee and or the employer or both puts money into an account. There's no particular guarantee as to what that account will be worth when you retire. You're essentially putting money in and hope it gets invested well and hope the investments pay off. And so the predominant form of retirement account now that we have is one that doesn't guarantee a result. It just is a savings account. Pensions work on a completely different theory. Pensions are designed on the notion that the employer, maybe with employee contributions, maybe not, the employer will set aside money during a person's working life, and when they retire, that pension plan will have enough money to pay them a fixed paycheck for life. In the 1960s and 70s, pensions were the dominant form of retirement account by far. And then, unfortunately, the federal government the federal government assumed that everybody would do a pension. And so they said, we're going to make the rules more stringent to employers. If you offer a pension, you have to guarantee the result. If you offer a pension, you are a legal fiduciary, and therefore if there is any fraud in the plan, you're responsible for that, et cetera. And the result of that was that this landmark pension legislation, which happened in 1974, unfortunately led a lot of employers, ultimately the majority of employers, to say, you know something, I don't want to offer a pension at all. I'll switch to the individual accounts. And as a result, from the 1970s to today, the market share of pensions has dropped. But, as I started by saying, there are still about 70
million people.
There
are still some out there.
Yeah, there are still many, many of them out there. To give you just a sense of orders of magnitude, oh, there's probably $8 trillion in pension funds in the United States, round numbers.
Okay. What I was trying to say at the beginning was that if I'm a young person today starting out in private industry in particular, the likelihood of me getting a pension is fill in the blank.
It's clearly a minority. I can't give you an exact figure, but most places these days to new employees don't offer a traditional pension. Most places in most new employees are not offered a pension. They're offered an individual savings account. The exception there is government.
Right.
And most public employees are, in fact, offered a traditional pension.
Okay. And we will talk about public versus private. But why do we read that so many pensions are in jeopardy, that so many people who had this guarantee no longer feel secure in it? What has happened to bring us to this point?
A series of unfortunate events. In order to understand how pensions got into any difficulties at all, you first got to understand how they are funded. What happens is an employer says, when you retire, I'm going to pay so much money based on each year of work. And so then the question is, how do you decide how much money to put in the plan? If this year, next year, et cetera, until you retire? And the answer is you turn to actuaries. Actuaries then make two guesses. One guess is how long will you live after retirement? Or on average, how long will all the people who are in the pension plan live after retirement? And it turns out actuaries are pretty good at making those kind of guesses. They are experts in longevity, mortality, et cetera. However, the other guess is, how much will that money earn over the next 50 years? In the period of time when you're retiring and the period of time that you have when you're working and the period of time when you after you retired. So in order to do that, actuaries have to make a guess about what the returns on that money are going to be over a long period of time. And it turns out they're not very good at those guesses. And what happened was in the 1980s and 1990s, the actuaries were conservative. So they said, maybe if you have money and you invest it in a mixture of stocks and bonds, it'll do an average return of, say, 6%
mm-hmm.
or 7%. And in the 1990s, the markets did better than that. And as a result, pension returns were higher. They were 8 and 9, and in some cases, 10 or more. What happened then, unfortunately, is the actuary said, well, I guess we should raise our estimates. And so they did. And the problem is they raised them to 7 or 8 or 9, and the average return on the average pension portfolio has been much, much less than that for the last 20 years. And the result is that pension plans are underfunded. The amount of money that was set aside turns out to be less than the amount that's necessary to pay benefits. And that's, frankly, the result of the fact that the actuaries essentially guessed wrong, and they were not conservative in their initial guesses. To give you a comparison, north of the border in Canada,
mm-hmm.
they also have actuaries. They also do the same thing, except the actuaries in Canada have always used more conservative investment return assumptions. So as a result, Canadian pension plans are fully funded. American pension plans are underfunded.
Well, staying in the private sector, because the public sector, that exactly is the case, and in many cases, governments don't put away, thinking somehow they can fix this down the road. And we certainly have that here in the state of Connecticut, where I'm coming from. But there are pension plans run by individual companies and multi-employer plans. Now, I'm reading where the multi-employer, multi-state plans are in real jeopardy, many of them at risk of going broke. But I thought that they were supposed to be a hedge, so you can blend all these companies and all their various situations, some good years, some bad years, and the like. So what's happened in the case of both individual and these multi-state or multi-employer plans?
Let's not multi-state, multi-employer plans. Let's first talk about the typical pension plan. The typical pension plan is offered by one company to its employees.
Mm-hmm.
General Motors has a pension plan. IBM has a pension plan. PepsiCo, et cetera. So all these. Now, what happens when they're underfunded? The answer is the employers go, whatever is the form of profanity that they're allowed, they say, oh, God, and they put in more money. And so in 99% or 90s percent of the cases of single employer plans, which is the majority of plans and the majority of people in plans,
mm-hmm.
what happens when they're underfunded is the employers go, damn, and they put more money in, and the plans don't fail, and the people get their pensions. There are, however, pensions which are called multi-employer pensions or Taft-Hartley pensions, et cetera, whatever you want to call them, and these are pensions in industries where there is a union on one side and a lot of employers on the other. For example, let's take the construction industry. In the construction industry, there are lots of small construction companies. It makes no sense for them, for each of these small businesses, to set up a pension plan. And so what they do is they form an industry association. The industry association negotiates with the carpenters union or the laborers union or whatever, et cetera. And they set up the carpenters plan for New England or the laborers plan for the central U.S. And those plans cover round numbers of about 10 million people in America. And you find them in a whole range of industries. You find them in the food industry. You find them in the trucking industry. You find them, a lot of them, in the construction industry. You find them in healthcare. And so there are lots of them. And those plans, too, had the same problem that the single employers had, which is, in the 90s, their actuaries guessed low, and so the plans ended up having more money than necessary. They were overfunded. So the actuaries changed the assumptions, and over the last 20 years, multi-employer plans have become underfunded. Now, why then don't the employers just dig into their pockets and pay more? Because some of these plans are in industries where a lot of the employers have gone out of business. For example, let's take the coal mining industry.
Mm-hmm.
The coal mining industry, the part of it that is union, negotiated a pension, I think, in the 1940s or 50s. And there were lots of coal companies back then. And there were lots of coal miners back then. And so for every hour that a coal miner worked as part of the union contract, there was money that went into the mine workers' pension fund. And then what happened? The coal industry shrunk. Coal companies went out of business. And so the mine workers' plan, which is very seriously underfunded, there are 100,000 people who are counting on a pension from the mine workers' pension plan. But there are only 10,000 active miners and only one or two coal companies left. So the question is, can those people, can the people who are still working afford to pay enough to cover the pension shortfall for the 10 times as many people who are not? No, they can't. And so these plans are not just underfunded, but they're underfunded. They have a high ratio of what we call orphan liabilities. Mm. In other words, pension obligations from employers who are no longer there. And they can't solve the problem by just tightening their belts and having the remaining workers pay more and the remaining employers pay more, although they try, and that's what they've been doing for the last 10 years or so. Multi-employer plans, both the employer associations and the unions, have negotiated contracts that have increased the amount of money that goes into the pension plan. But for some of the plans, let's say 15% of the plans, mm-hmm. there just aren't enough there aren't enough active workers, there aren't enough active employers. There are too many orphans, and there is not enough money coming in to pay for it.
So that's where we turn to an organization that you ran for a while, the Pension Benefit Guarantee Corporation. Explain what the backstop responsibility of the corporation is. And, of course, most of us who are reading at all about this are reading that that fund is in some distress and may run out of funds in the coming period. So give us a little history of that and what its role is meant to be in times like these.
Okay. I mentioned the fact that in 1974 there was landmark pension legislation, the Employee Retirement Income Security Act, or ERISA. Really important legislation, really well-intentioned legislation. It had some unfortunate unintended consequences. But one of the things it did that is unalloyedly a good thing, in my biased opinion, was it said, well, what happens if a plan sponsor goes bankrupt and the plan is underfunded? Are those people going to lose their pensions? And so they set up a pension insurance agency, the Pension Benefit Guarantee Corporation, and the PBGC, as it's known, works like this. They charge premiums from plans, so many dollars per person per year, paid to PBGC, and when the sponsor of a plan goes bankrupt and the plan is underfunded, the PBGC becomes responsible for paying a pension benefit. Now, on the single employer side, two things are true. One is PBGC benefits are more generous. So for most people, on the single employer side, PBGC covers most of the pension benefit that people would get. Mm-hmm. The other thing that's true is on the single employer side is that PBGC doesn't get very many of those pensions because the employers pay for them. Most employers don't go bankrupt, and if they decide that they can't afford their pension, they still pay the obligations they already owe their employees. And so for most of the pension world, PBGC, A, doesn't get called very often, and when it does get called, it pays most of the pension. The multi-employer world, unfortunately, the PBGC program was not as well designed, in part because they thought, well, there's all those other employers. They can pick up the slack. They apparently never considered the possibility that all those other employers would go bankrupt and there would be nobody to pick up the slack. So they did two things that are a problem. One is they made PBGC premiums for multi-employer plans much lower than for single-employer plans. So now, round numbers, the average single employer pension plan pays PBGC 10 times the per person premium that the average multi-employer plan pays. So as a result, PBGC has more money to pay benefits for single employer side and needs them less often than it does to pay multi-employer benefits. The other issue is that PBGC benefits on the multi-employer side, because they thought they weren't going to be needed, are cheapskate. They don't pay a full pension unless your pension is very low. And so if you are in the multi-employer system world and your plan runs out of money, PBGC is supposed to pay a benefit, but that benefit will be lower than the pension that you're owed. And the PBGC doesn't have the money to pay even that. Let me give you a case that is on everybody's mind right now. There was a pension plan in the Midwest, the Central States Pension Fund, created by the Teamsters for truck drivers.
That's the one that you often read about, yes.
The Central States Pension Plan has about 400,000 people who are dependent on it for benefits. And it is, like all these other plans, it was overfunded in the 90s and became underfunded in this century. And they are, Teamster pensions are pretty generous. So pensions in there can be $20,000 or $30,000 a year. Now, granted, this is for people who are making $40,000 and $50,000, so it's not a, but those pensions are pretty generous. So let's say you're going to get a pension from Central States of $30,000 a year. If that plan were taken over by the PBGC and the PBGC had money to pay for it, you wouldn't get $30,000. The most you would get is about $13,000. So that's a big cut. Now, so $30,000 to $13,000, round numbers. The actual number is $12,870, but if you've been there for 30 years, but let's say 13, 30 to 13. However, if the PBGC doesn't have any money in its fund, then you're not even going to get the $13,000. At that point, you might be lucky to get $1,000. That's the issue that is causing people heartburn right now, which is they see that there are some plans, and we should be very clear, this is a minority of plans. They see some plans are going to run out of money, and they see that the federal agency that is supposed to take care of them has benefits that are too low and doesn't have the money to pay even those benefits. So now there's been a series of attempts to figure out, well, what do we do?
Right. These fixes are different, Republicans and Democrats. Where are they? There's this Butch-Lewis Act. There are ways of giving loans versus really just giving money directly to the PBGC. Where does it stand right now?
Okay. There have been multiple attempts. In 2010 was the first one. And in 2010, two members of Congress and Senator Casey of Pennsylvania said, these plans are the plans that are in trouble are underfunded. It's not as if the retirees caused this problem. So why don't we take taxpayer dollars and make up the difference? And unfortunately for that effort, this occurred in 2010 after the Congress had just bailed out the banks and the auto industry, and people said no more bailouts. So that idea died. 2013, the industry came forward and said, all right, we're not going to ask for a bailout, but what we need is a process that enables us to restructure our pension plans. And by restructure is a polite term for cut benefits some now in order to avoid cutting them entirely later. And so in 2013 and 2014, the Congress considered, and after the 2014 election, passed a bill, the Multi-Employer Pension Reform Act. And under that bill, if a pension plan could show that by cutting benefits some now, it would have enough money to avoid running out of money entirely later, as long as it cut benefits such that they were better than PBGC benefits, they could do it. So MIPR passed in 2014, and the only issue was that the Central States Pension Plan, which was the pension plan around which the law was designed, they developed a plan to cut benefits that they thought would save their thing, and they sent it to the Treasury Department for review, and the Treasury Department chickened out. They said, well, it's 2015, in a year, there's going to be an election, and we don't want, in that case it was the Democrats, we don't want the Democratic administration charged with cutting pension benefits. So they chickened out, and they essentially gutted MIPRA. So that was 2014, 15, 16. What happened after that is the industry came back again and said, how about this? How about instead of giving taxpayer dollars, we would like the federal government to loan the plans a chunk of money, what in fact is several hundred billion dollars, loan them the money, charge them interest at the federal rate, say 2%, let them invest the money, and that money, they hope, will earn, let's say, 6% or 7%. So the difference between the 2% that gets paid to the government as interest and the 6% or 7% over a long period of time, if you get enough money, would enable these plans to recover, most of them. So that was the proposal, which we now call the Butch-Lewis Act. So it was a proposal essentially to set up an office in the Treasury to make a series of loans, and over a long period of time with a large number of dollars, that would enable most of these plans to survive. There was precedent for this. For example, the U.S. government gave loans to the steel industry. The U.S. government gave loans to the airline industry, et cetera. So there was precedent for this. However, it was an idea which Democrats supported and Republicans did not. So
where are we today?
We're almost there. The last year, the Congress, to its credit, appointed a special committee, half senators, half congressmen, half Democrats, half Republicans, and said to the special committee, dear special committee, if you can figure out a compromise that a majority of Democrats and a majority of Republicans accept, nobody's going to be happy with it, but accept, then we'll consider it. So the Democrats started by proposing this loan program, the Butch-Lewis Act. The Republicans said, we are not comfortable having taxpayer dollars go directly to the funds, but we might be willing to have taxpayer dollars go to the Pension Benefit Guaranty Corporation, which is, after all, a federal agency.
Mm-hmm.
And so what the staff of the special committee worked out is a complicated process which said, in effect, that the Pension Benefit Guaranty Corporation, which already has authority to take over orphan obligations, can take over orphan obligations from these plans, can, and when it does so, it will pay benefits at a higher level than currently, so that instead of, to go back to your example of the $30,000 Central States pension, instead of having that person go from 30,000 to 13, under their proposal last year, the 30,000 would have gone down to about 25. Now, where does all that money come from to pay these additional benefits? And that's where they did a good but ultimately unsuccessful job. They said, okay, suppose the taxpayers put in half of it and the pension industry that is benefiting from this program puts up the other half. In other words, raise TBGC premiums, charge retirees who are in the multi-employer system a premium for the fact that their industry is guaranteed. So the committee last year came up with a series of, essentially, think of them as fees. Fees to retirees, fees to unions, fees to businesses, fees to pension plans. And what they were trying to do was get to the point where private industry paid half the cost of this new scheme. And they almost got there, but they did not get all the way there. They produced their proposal last November, and it is it died with the last Congress. So what's going on now? What's going on now is in the United States Senate, they're back at it. And what they are trying to do is, both Democrats and Republicans, is not in public, but working with each other, are trying to see if they can make an approach like that work. Can they find a way under which the PBGC becomes responsible for orphan obligations and gets enough money from some combination of taxpayer dollars and industry funds to cover the cost? And if they do that and reach an agreement on it, then that will probably become the preferred approach because it will have been agreed upon by both Democrats and Republicans.
And the haircut that most individual retirees involved in these programs would have to take could really be limited,
much more so.
With all of this, I mean, how many people in America are probably listening to this, hopefully all of them, listening to this with great fear, trepidation, direct interest in the results of this? I mean, what numbers are we talking about here?
Okay, we've already mentioned Central States, which has about 400,000 people in it.
Mm-hmm.
So think 400,000 people plus their families. Okay, so that's what? 750,000 people just in Central States.
Mm-hmm.
There's no one who knows for sure, but the best estimates of the number of people that would lose their pensions if nothing gets done is something on the order of 1.5 million people.
Mm.
The most precise estimate, which by the way is not precise, it's just the one with the most words and numbers behind it, is 1.3 million people. So let's take the 1.3 million people plus their families are at risk of losing the pensions they've worked on their whole lives. That's what people are trying to avoid.
Now, we've been talking primarily about the private sector, and I know that we have used up most of our time. Do you want to say anything about the risks involved in public pensions? I know I've talked to people at the Manhattan Institute, and they have talked about some perilous situations in Illinois, New Jersey, Connecticut, a number of other places. Is there anything that you'd like to add to that conversation?
Yes, I think it is. It's unfortunately the case that public pensions have been the result of a scare campaign that has completely distorted both the issues and the size of the problem. My colleague, Louise Shaner, with two co-authors, just literally a week or two ago, did an estimate of what it would take, did a whole series of estimates. It's a long paper with many simulations attached to it. Mm-hmm. Did an estimate of what the cost would be if over the next 30 years you want to essentially keep the size of the public pension debt as a percentage of the economy as a whole constant. and their estimate is that it would, I'm picking the midpoint of a series of estimates, but that if you say, I want to solve this problem over 30 years, and you think that the investments in the markets will earn about 3.5% before inflation, 5.5% with inflation, then the additional cost on average nationwide is that public payrolls would go up by 4%. 4% on average. So is this, if you discovered that the people who work for you or if in a particular agency, if the cost of healthcare went up 4%, people would do triple handsprings and say it's only that low?
Yeah.
Okay. So I think the issue on public pension funds has been the result of real scaremongering. And what they do is they say, let's look at all the obligations from now until forever of these pension funds. And then let's discount them to present value at a low discount rate. And there are good economic reasons for using a low discount rate, but the result is you get an enormous number. So you will hear stories of $4 trillion or $5 trillion of public pension shortfalls. What you don't hear is, and how much money over the next 50 years will be available to pay for that? And that was the real contribution that Louise Shaner made and her colleagues. They said, well, looks like on average about 4% of payroll. Now, one thing I will say, since you talked to Mr. Malang at the Manhattan Institute, is he is on a tear about how folks in Illinois and New Jersey and probably Connecticut, since he was talking to you, are being financially irresponsible with pensions. And they have been. However, one of the things that Mr. Malanga did is he said, and these are all Democratic states, and what he didn't bother to check was who had run those states. And if you actually go back and look over the last 40 years, Republicans have run New Jersey more time than have Democrats. If you look over the last 40 years, Republicans have run the state of Illinois more than Democrats. And so I don't think this is a Democratic issue or a Republican issue. I think this
by no means in Connecticut. It's a bipartisan mess that we've created.
And that is right. And so there's a lot of finger pointing. There's a lot of phony numbers. But if people are actually willing to put aside the finger pointing and stop trying to assess blame and say, okay, what will it take to solve this if we solve it over a long period of time? In most cases, they'll be able to solve the problem.
Josh Gottbaum, I thank you so much for being with us today from the Brookings Institution and a former director of the Pension Benefit Guarantee Corporation. Thanks again. If anybody wants to read up on some of the material that you've been talking about through the Brookings Institution, how can they do that?
Fortunately, Brookings has a retirement security project, which has papers by some of my colleagues, all of whom are better lettered than I, and also a homepage on that. So I would say look there. I would also give a shout out to Boston College's Center for Retirement Research.
Yes.
In my view, the preeminent academic place to study pension policy issues. And so if you go to the Boston College's Center for Retirement Research, you will get a wealth of carefully researched, really thoughtful work.
Thank you so much for being with us today on America Trends.
Great. Take care.
America Trends podcast is part of the MHNR Network. MHNRnetwork.com.